Hello and welcome to Holden. Today is August the 26th, 1999, and this morning in Koinonia Fireside Room is Paul Palumbo, and his session is called In Laws of the Law, number 99-4. Let's listen.
The story of Judah and Tamar. It's quite an interesting story, isn't it? So we're going to take a look at it today. But first, let us pray. Gracious God, in thanksgiving, we approach your word again. And as much as we are dreading it, we pray, O Lord, that you will turn us upside down with it again, to show us the way you are, the way you enter our lives, the means by which we may see you. Amen. I started out this morning asking if anybody was interested in recapping the story. It was a pretty shy bunch. So if there's anybody that would like to do that here, that's fine, or else I can just run through it real quick. I'm sorry, Judah. Genesis 38. 38, yes. Yes. Good morning. Well, okay, well, let me run through it because it's a story worth telling. Judah, we're right smack in the middle of the story of Joseph, right? Chapter 37 is Joseph is telling his dreams to his brothers and to his parents, and he's basically driving his brothers crazy with these dreams about their stars bowing to his star and their sheaths bowing to his sheaths, and he's one of the youngest, so and still he's saying these crazy things, and they decide they're gonna get rid of him. And first they're gonna kill him out in the fields there. But then Judah says, well, let's not kill him, let's throw him in the pit here. We shouldn't kill him, and then we'll just sell him into slavery. And so they sell him into slavery. These traveling people are going down to Egypt. They sell Joseph to those folks, and they take him down to Egypt. And that's where this story enters in. At that same time, Judah, this is now, Judah is one of the brothers of Joseph. He settled in near an Adullamite whose name was Hira. Now Hira becomes his friend, and he finds this, Judah finds a wife there, marries her, and has three children. Onan, and Shelah. And then as they grow up, he finds a wife for the oldest, because the oldest gets married first, and it happens to be Tamar. Now, for some reason, we're not told, is wicked in the eyes of the Lord, and God kills No more commentary on it. God just kills him. So Tamar is left, and they haven't had any kids. And so as we have talked about previously, is dead, and he doesn't have any connection to the land of the living. There he is in Sheol. He's got no descendants. He's got nobody to carry on his name. And that's not good. So it is a Levirate law that says that the brother of the dead man should go and take the wife and have children for the sake of the dead man and carry on his name. Well, Onan is next in line, and for one reason or another, he decides that he doesn't want to have children for his brother. And so every time he has sexual intercourse with Tamar, he pulls out just at the crucial time, spills his semen on the ground, and they never have a child. This displeases the Lord greatly. And so God takes the life of Onan too. So there's Judah, and he's 0 for 2, right? He's got two boys, and they're both dead. And he's got a third who's not yet old enough to be somebody's husband. So Judah starts thinking real fast. He says, I got two gone and I only have one left. I'm going to have to do something with this. So he says to Tamar, go back to the family of your father. And when Shelah is old enough, I'll send him to you. And he will take care of the Levirate law. He will marry you. Judah has no intention of sending Shelah to her because he thinks that she's killing his sons. Not literally, but that something's going on with Tamar because he's not going to send his third son to her. Well, in the meantime, Judah's wife dies and he goes through his time of grief, and then he goes to check on his goats, his sheep. He's going to shear some sheep. And on the way, Tamar hears that Judah's going to go up to look at his sheep, and he has to pass right by. So she goes and finds a place in a doorway there, looks and sees that Shelah is old enough now to be a husband, but that she hasn't heard word one from Judah about it. So she starts to thinking. So she goes and takes off the clothes of a widow. She puts on the scarf and dresses up. This sits by the door. Judah comes by, and lo and behold, Judah sees her, doesn't recognize her, thinks she's a prostitute, and says, all right, well, I'm finished with my time of mourning, and so how about if you and I do some business here? And she says, well, all right, what are you going to give me? And he says, well, I'll give you a kid from my, a goat from my herd here. She says, huh, yeah, big words, but I know you nomadic types. What are you going to give me as a deposit? And he says, well, I'll give you my signet and my cord and around me and my staff. She says, fair enough. So that's good. She takes those things. And they go in. They have sexual intercourse. Tamar gets pregnant by Judah, her father-in-law. Yeah, watch out now. So so time passes. He goes and shears the sheep, whatever he's going to do. And then he remembers, oh, yeah, I owe this woman a kid. So he sends Hira with a kid to go and find the prostitute and pay her and get back his signet and his cord and his staff. Well, Hira goes to the town where they were, looks around, can't find a prostitute, asks around very discreetly about the prostitute that used to be here. They say, what prostitute? There's no prostitute who lives here. So he can't find her. So he goes back to Judah. Judah says, that's okay, leave it alone. She can keep all the stuff. It's embarrassing enough as it is. So that's what happens. 3 months pass. And after 3 months, word comes to Judah that Tamar has played the whore. And she's pregnant by whoredom. To which Judah responds altogether too eagerly, I think, bring her out to be burned. And so they bring her out, and while they're bringing her out, Tamar calmly sends the signet and the cord and the staff to Judah and says, the owner of these things is the father of my child. And Judah looks at these things, and he recognizes them as his, and he says the strangest thing. She is more righteous than I. And then Tamar's left, She's not burned at all. Judah does not have any other sexual relations with her. But then she has two kids. And she has twins. And there you have it. That's the story. Any reaction to the story?
Wow.
Wow. It's a wild story, isn't it? Isn't it something? Yes.
Would a righteous man go to a prostitute in that culture? Is that something that's looked really down on, or was this a common thing, or I'm not familiar with that.
Would a righteous man go to a prostitute?
Prostitutes are never mentioned.
I mean, would the community look down on it because he's inquiring around the community where the prostitute?
Probably would look down on the prostitute more than on the man.
Right.
Things haven't changed a whole lot. I mean, on that score. It's a pretty casual thing, it seems to me, here in this story. Part of the problem is that this is not just a prostitute, it's a temple prostitute that he thinks she is, okay? And we talked a little bit about this, I don't know when, I think with Ruth maybe, or in the first day or two, but in the Canaanite, where they are, right, the Canaanite fertility cult is very clear. And it's you have land, you have farming to farm to till, and the Canaanites know how to farm the land, and part of their religion is this fertility cult, and so you go to the temple prostitutes and you have sexual intercourse with them, and somehow in the heavens the gods have sexual intercourse as a result, and then the whole ground is fertile. And everything's ready to go. It's a pretty nice setup if you're a farmer, I think, you know. So
it started back here, way back in Genesis, and then was put a stop to it in the site.
Well,
is that right? I mean, it was going on all the
time. It was going on all that time, and when this is well before the Israelites are freed from Egypt and go into the land and all that. But remember, God says to the people of Israel when you go into the land, you don't have anything to do with those Canaanites. Don't mix with them. Okay? Don't have the same kind of religion as them. It's different. But, you know, that's just too attractive. I'm sorry. You know, for nomads who have been in the wilderness for 40 years to enter into that kind of land, well, they of course they participate in that, even though it's forbidden. So, yeah. So Judah is, he goes to her, and it's not, I don't think it's a big deal right here. You know, so that's my opinion. Other reactions? Yes.
Well, it seems to me that Tamar's situation is a little bit like Ruth was, in the sense that she's been living in her father's house, she's been sent back to her father's house. Her future doesn't look too bright, and she knows she's supposed to become the wife of the next brother, and the father-in-law is not sending him to her. So I think she's looking out for herself, and perhaps for what she sees as being the right thing to do, or carrying it out in one way or another, that she's looking out for herself, but I think she may be looking out for her husband's too.
Excellent. Yes. Absolutely. I think the connection with Ruth is right, and I think it's also right that she's not just looking out for herself, but looking out for her dead husband. Her. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes.
Yeah. Along the same lines, it's I'm asking myself, well, why is this story, how did the story ever get into the Bible in the first place? It's kind of embarrassing.
It's a great question.
And maybe it's, you know, again, it reinforces the idea that to Hebrew men, because I think most scriptures are addressed to Hebrew men, women are awfully wily, crafty, seductive. And if you're going to have sex with one, be sure you take their veil off first.
Well, you know, there's a long tradition. I mean, I'm not sure if that's the actual message, but there's a long tradition of men being surprised by the women that they're having sex with. In the sense of you've got Boaz who remember he wakes up and there she is, right, in the middle of the night. There's Ruth, but remember Jacob and the story of Rachel and Leah. Where he works for 7 years for his uncle Laban so that he can marry Rachel, because Rachel is beautiful and Leah is not so beautiful. And the wedding night comes, and Rachel enters into Jacob's tent. And in the morning, he wakes up to find that, lo and behold, he hasn't been sleeping with Rachel. After all, he's been sleeping with Leah. And Laban says, "What? You expect me to give you the younger daughter before you marry the older one?" And so he has to work for 7 more years in order to marry the Rachel whom he loves, right? So there is that theme does kind of recur. It's kind of funny.
Is the Perez? At the end, is he in the genealogy of somebody?
Oh, yes, absolutely. He's right smack in the middle of something. Yes, David.
Okay.
And also he's in the genealogy of our Lord. So,
right. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah.
It's another one of those ancestors that was not an exemplary kind of situation, maybe? Or would they look at it that way?
Well, it certainly is. It is a situation to raise eyebrows at. But I think it is a very much an exemplary story. But by Tamar, not by Judah. Because Tamar, the key to the whole thing is Judah's response, right? When Judah finds out that first he finds out that Tamar's pregnant, right? And I said that he rather quickly says, "Bring her out to burn her." I think he does that precisely because he thinks something's wrong with Tamar, that his boys are being killed. That his boys are dying. And he's not going to let his third son die. And that means he's not going to let him go to Tamar. And this is what's in his mind. Tamar is bad news. There's something wrong with her, and my boys are being killed as a result. Right? So there he is. He's stuck. He's got the Levirate law, which says that when a woman's husband dies, the husband of the brother of the husband should go and have children, marry the woman, right, and have children, and thereby allow the dead man a connection to the land of the living, and allow his name to go on, right. And Judah is totally, this is law, this isn't just a suggestion, okay? This is what it's supposed to be. Because when a woman marries a man, she's not just marrying the man, she's marrying the man and his family and his clan and his tribe, right? We don't have that notion. I think it would be much more realistic, and a lot of problems might be avoided if we did have this idea. You know, you're not just marrying one person, but you're marrying their whole family. And that's for good and for ill. Right? So, that's real strong here. And Judah has a real strong obligation as the head of that family to Tamar, that he is avoiding as quick as he can, as much as he can. So when so when Tamar takes things into her own hands and makes Judah do what is supposed to be done for her, she is fulfilling the righteousness of the law. Okay, she is proclaimed righteous.
Oh, and she had two children, and she had two husbands. So would that mean that she had one for each of them?
No, but in the beauty of the story, it balances out, doesn't it? Judah loses two sons, but then gains two sons. That's kind of a nice thing. They're Ur's kids. Her first husband.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So the second one wouldn't...
They're both his.
Maybe he already had other children, let's say.
Who's that?
The second son.
No, the second son, Onan, didn't have any kids either.
Not by her, but maybe.
Oh, maybe. Oh, we don't know. Yeah, that's not... Probably not, but we don't know. Mm-hmm. It's not told. So,
If they're Ur's kids, then how come Judah's the one who's listed in the genealogy?
Well, he's the father, but what I mean is that Ur is the one who's it's for the sake of Ur who's died. They're again, it's that business of when you're in Sheol and you don't have any kids, you're cut off from the clan, the family and the clan. But if you have kids, then it's counted for Ur as having kids. And Judah is the father of them. So he would be in the genealogy. Well, so Tamar does what is righteous, what is right, and we need to probably talk a little bit about that word. The Hebrew word is tzedek, and it means not righteousness in the sense that we probably think about it, you know, religiously, you know, we're righteous and all that. But that's a way to look at it, but the way in which it's used here is much more in the sense of the way things are supposed to be. Okay? Tamar has made things work out the way they were intended to be, or the way they were supposed to be. The way the community and the law is supposed to come together. And it's in that sense that Tamar is more righteous than Judah. Judah was trying his best to avoid things coming out the way they're supposed to. He was trying to avoid him taking his obligation seriously. She, on the other hand, makes it right. Now, the way you can think about this is that the story is told about... A pastor who was in Israel, and he was driving, and he and his driver, his Israeli driver, was driving him somewhere, and the car kind of broke down, and they got a mechanic under there, and he was trying to fix the car, and they were trying to start it, wouldn't start, and he was 45 minutes under the hood of the car, and kind of muttering and fixing stuff and fooling around, and finally the car turned on, right? And the mechanic goes, Zedek! It works! It works the way it's supposed to work. And so that's the kind of righteousness that we're talking about here, okay, in the story. That it's working the way it's supposed to work. Judah is, I think, part of this story, the fascinating part of this story is that it turns all of our notions of what's good and what's bad on its head. And now I'm going to throw this out as a question. How do you respond to this story?
Well,
or, you know, how did you notice that you were responding to the story? Yeah.
Well, I guess I can only share from personal experience. I guess I spent some time in Korea before and then after the war. And there was lots of fraternization going on, as there is, has been through all wars, okay? Lots of girlfriends and all that kind of stuff. But I learned a new respect, appreciation for prostitutes, okay, if you want to call them that, the girlfriend. Because these women did not just take care of themselves. They took care of whole neighborhoods. They took care of kids. It was a family thing. If they had a boyfriend that could supply them with money or food or whatever it was, they did not use it for themselves. Okay? There were whole neighborhoods. There were guys that I knew that were doing this. And I saw kids that would have starved and old people that would have starved had it not been for this relationship. And so for that relationship, when we talk about prostitution, it has a different meaning for me since that time.
Yeah.
They were doing a good thing, okay? Under the circumstances, things were very difficult then. People were going without food and lots of work and all that kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah. Huh. Really important thing to remember, I think.
So making a judgment on somebody, if we need to be very careful how we judge another person until you know all of the circumstances. And we're warned about that, of course, in the Bible, not to be that judgmental. But, but anyway,
right.
That's the way it comes to me.
Very good, thanks.
Was the fact that she put on a veil make her a prostitute, or was there some other... I mean, how do you recognize walking down the street? Oh, there's one, you know.
I suppose that... that it isn't so hard to pick out a prostitute. I mean, any more than it is in the cities or anywhere else. Here, you know, you could be wrong and you could approach somebody. But for example, right? They know how to dress to impose as. And let's be real clear about this. Tamar is not a prostitute. She's a prostitute imposter, right? And it is, like I said, it's the temple cult prostitute. So there may have been some kind of clothing that they wore to signal them out. I don't know. But Tamar is not, and this is kind of an interesting thing. I mean, the idea is we think Tamar is a prostitute. Right? She's not a prostitute at all. She's impersonating a prostitute. Okay? No? Is that...
In order to do what she thinks is right.
In order to do what... Right. In order to take care of the whole Levirate situation where the brother is supposed to come and have children for the sake of the dead brother.
But wouldn't there have been other ways for her to convince Judah to get that son to her without sleeping with him?
I think that it's pretty clear that Judah is not sending him. You know? I don't know what other power Tamar has. Maybe there are other ways. I mean, we could brainstorm that. But this is what she chooses to do. And I think it makes for a really good story that way. But I also think that Judah is afraid of her, and is afraid to lose his last son. Yeah.
Can the father-in-law be a substitute for a son in meeting the requirements of the law?
Yes.
Okay, so she was basically forcing conformity with the law, albeit without his.
Right. He really should not have done that, probably. But you know, in the story, his wife dies, so and it really should be the brother. But you take which one you can get. in this case, and it happens to be the father-in-law. Yeah.
I thought she was clever in sending him basically all the evidence.
Yes.
That of who the father was.
Oh, yeah.
That gave him sort of a lot of control and took away all her power in one sense, except for one, and that is she knew she was carrying two hostages in her womb if she was stoned, his sons or children would have died with her.
Ah.
And so by doing this in this way, it kept the secret between them. And so she knew that because he would know that by stoning her he would be killing his own kin, mm-hmm. that she would be
killed. Huh. So you're saying his indiscretion is covered up by her discretion.
Right.
And that adds to that would add to her to his kind of being convicted of something. Convicted that he was that she was right.
Right.
Yeah.
And also gave him a way to save face
right.
in the community.
Yes.
And enabled her to basically her goal was accomplished of just quietly being reassimilated back into
yes.
his family.
Right. Excellent. That's probably true because remember how embarrassing it is because he sends the kid by way of his friend, and the friend can't find her, right? And so he kind of says, "Well, just let her keep it." You know, he wants to keep it hush hush. And so, yeah, I think that's really good. Yeah, there was.
I don't think she had any other choice because back in that. Society, she never could have gone and spoken to her father-in-law. I can't speak to my father-in-law about anything. And I can't, when I think way back then, there's no way she could have said, you know, we need to do something about this.
Right.
If I can't do that now, there's no way she could have done it.
Yeah.
You know, she had no choice.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think that she had to go about it with a lot of smarts. Yeah. Absolutely. Other comments? Yes.
I've just been continually, I was with a Bible study that we were studying the entire book of Genesis, and it always seems like so often these guys who are supposed to be, you know, like they're in the lineage of Jesus, and several of them are the heroes of the faith and so on, they did a lot of really stupid, dumb things.
Oh.
You know?
It continues
with
this thing.
Yeah. Yeah, right. That's the saving grace of the whole stories.
Yeah. But I mean, it's just, in some ways, it's sort of comforting to sort of think that, you know, well, God could even work in all of this and in all of these situations and with doofuses that, you know, don't seem to ever get it. But then that means, you know, there's hope for everybody.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And Judas certainly falls into that category in this story. I mean, he's really he's not portrayed well at all. It's pretty funny. Did you?
Yeah, I was just going to mention I bought a book by Sarna about the book of Genesis.
Uh-huh.
And one of the comments that author makes is that this story would really have been frowned upon by later Jewish temple people, and so that the fact that it's included speaks to its antiquity.
Uh-huh.
That mentioned other stories, I don't remember now what they were, but the fact this is included in the Old Testament when it really doesn't meet later standards, so to speak.
Right.
Verifies the antiquity of it, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tenacious story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's hard to figure out where else to put it. It doesn't really fit here. It does in some ways. We're going to look at that too. But you get the flow of the Joseph story interrupted by this story, mm-hmm. this really far out story of Judah and Tamar. But there are connections with the Joseph and the Jacob cycle and the Joseph cycle and the. In this story, there are connections. Yeah.
I'm identifying with Judah as a parent. And mm-hmm. A I think that it's easy for parents to lay blame outside the family.
Mm-hmm.
So why wouldn't he? I mean, his sons must have been wonderful, and why were they a kid? But also, why would he want to send his third son thinking that he was going to be killed too?
Yeah. Well, right. He does, he's trying to protect.
I wouldn't.
Right? Yeah. Right? Given his assumptions.
Sure.
Sure.
With the information that he had at that time.
Yeah.
If he were to read it now, he might do it differently.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I guess we don't have that luxury of knowing.
The hindsight is always better.
Yeah, right. But it is interesting because one of the connections that it strikes me with the story that is the Joseph story is, remember, Joseph has Benjamin, and Benjamin is the last son of his beloved Rachel, because Joseph in his mind is dead, right? And the brothers come back and say that well, you got a brother in jail in Egypt, and we need Benjamin in order to go reclaim him. And what does Jacob say?
No way.
He says, "No way, Hoss. This is my last son from Rachel. I'm not sending him. I'm not giving him up." Okay. Right? So, you know, like father, like son, maybe Jacob and Judah. Hmm. Yeah.
But how many parents would?
Yeah, right.
Abraham.
For one. Come on, she's trying to make a point here. God for another, you know. Yes.
I find two surprises in the story. One is there's a sense of honor. I know that sounds crazy, but the idea that Judah follows through with his sense of obligation to her with sending his friend with the kid.
Mm-hmm.
And that he even bothered to give her the signet and the staff and the, I forget what the third thing was.
Cord. The cord.
The cord,
yeah.
Right. You know, in our own modern day world, we think of those kind of casual encounters as one night stands, and there's, you know, a clean break afterwards. There's no sense of any kind of obligation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's clearly not the case here. It's not like she has to wangle that out of him. It's stated up front, and he agrees to it, and then he follows through with that. And I find that sort of surprising, that there's that kind of notion of some kind of ongoing obligation or relationship beyond just that sort of casual one-night stand. That's sort of, there's something refreshing about that, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Hmm.
That sexual encounters are not just mere casual things or events, but there's some sense of a larger picture, even though it's not the picture that Judah thought he was getting into, still, there was this sense of a larger scope. And the other surprise is that God redeems us even in the midst of our indiscretions.
Mm.
And that's for Tamar as well as for Judah. Tamar, the indiscretion that she has to pose, but still she's redeemed in that. And Judah, that he is submitting to something that he didn't really need to, but chose to in a moment of indiscretion. And yet somehow it all works out right for both of us.
Huh. Yeah, you use that word right at the end, and I think that's right. It does work. It reminds one of the Joseph, what Joseph says to his brothers, right? When he finally reveals himself in Egypt. Remember, Joseph says, what you meant for evil, God intended for good. Mm-hmm. Right? And so it does have that flavor of God's redemption in the end. You read the the encounter with the business transaction between Judah and Tamar a little differently than I did. I kind of read it with this is a desperate man. He's given away a lot of stuff here for deposit for one night, right? And that he follows up with the, you know, that's not it is kind of remarkable that, you know, well, he sends his friend to seek out and pay and get back his stuff, but I think that also for Judah, at least one way of looking at it, your way I think has got a lot of validity too, is that by sending this kid he cuts off that. All right, so now he doesn't have there's no loose ends. He ties them all up by sending this kid, and when it comes back to him, that's when he starts getting a little nervous. He says, well, let it be that way. She can keep that stuff, and you know, it's just not good, you know, there's something almost something foreshadowing about that for him, that you know, that's uneasy because there are loose ends now. And more loose ends than he ever imagined, obviously, right? But
so. He wouldn't have had cash in his pocket. I mean, his kid was his cash.
Yeah, right. You know? Right. Yeah, and she was real smart to get a deposit. I think I thought that was really tricky. Yeah.
The comment I had on that was in that time, I understand that an agreement. An unwritten agreement was always carried out. It didn't have to be written down.
Right.
And maybe that was the conscience here, that because he did make an agreement with her.
Yes.
That was driving into,
part of the honor business. Yeah, I think that's true. I think there is a sense of honor in that. Yeah. Did you have something?
Yeah, I agree with, the sense of honor in that respect. And yet, the other side is, Tamar had not been married for a long time. She was whereas Judah was a widower.
Right.
She was a widow, had not been married for a long time. And when Judah finds out that she's pregnant, she should be burned.
You're right.
So, it's the old
double standard.
Double standard. Yeah. I can do it, but she can't, and she should be burned for it. So, yes, there is a sense of honor and so on, but that comes out loud and clearly to me.
Right, and part of the double standard of that time it's embedded in the notion of property. Mm-hmm. Because a man can only commit adultery against another man. See, in this sense, if you have two couples here, and this man has an affair with this man's wife, he's committing adultery not against her but against him, because the wife is his property. See,
yeah.
So he's defaming somebody's property. And if it's not the husband, it's the father. Okay?
Sure.
Right? So, and of course, a woman is, she's committing it. You're right.
Yeah.
And she's guilty of the adultery because, again, against the person whose property she is.
Mm.
Huh? So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because everything sort of works out according to law at the end of the story, I don't see this story as subversive in quite the same way as the Rachel story was, or the Ruth
story
was subversive.
Ah.
In fact, I don't see it as really as subversive at all.
Right.
I think what it's saying is the law is the law, it should be obeyed, and it's important, even unto death. I mean, suppose Tamar really did have this property of being able, of killing the men she was married to, he was still supposed to marry her anyway. or his son was supposed to. And so I see it as a story about the importance of the law, and the kind of the rather bizarre twists and turns of life as to how the law eventually kind of works out. But I don't see this as a subversive story.
Right.
Except that with Ruth.
Weren't the actions that most of the people took in this story based on relationships rather than law? And so they hadn't received the law yet, but they still must have had, well, they did have these tribal kinds of ways of doing things. But still, they were basing their actions on either their self-interest, according to their own family members, or Tamar to more personal, more communal.
It
all worked out.
Right.
According to the law in the end, more or less.
Uh huh.
But their decisions were not actually based on, let's see, what does the law tell me to do?
Right. I think that's a really good point too. I think you're right. It's not as subversive, but it is. It is instead. It's a bulwark, a support for the concept of the integrity of the community, the integrity of the family and the clan and the tribe. That these kind of rules that are set down are not there in the sense that we think of law, that, you know, these are things that have to be obeyed because they have to be obeyed because they have to be obeyed. But because they are, they enhance the integrity of the community. Okay, and when Judah acts against the integrity of the clan and the community, then things are not right. And it is Tamar who comes and sets them back right for the good of her dead husband and for the good of the whole clan. Yeah.
And I was going to say that for Ruth, it's not that much different, I don't think, because Boaz was supposed to be her redeemer kinsman. You know, she's come back from this other land, and she and her mother-in-law are both widows, and there was supposed to be some redeemer kinsman who should have taken care of them. Mm-hmm. Yet there they were living in utter extreme poverty, and she was having to go glean the fields to take care of her mother-in-law. And nobody was taking care of them. And in that case, it just so happened that Boaz happened to like Ruth, which worked out really nice. You know, so then they schemed a little bit. But there also, they were making things right according to the relationships or law or whatever, because Boaz was a redeemer kinsman. It turns out he wasn't the closest one, but most interested in.
Right.
Although I don't think the kinsman was by law obligated to Ruth, maybe to Naomi. I don't think he was obligated to Ruth. She was from another tribe.
Except that she became a full part of that community and went back. I mean, she was Naomi's daughter, basically daughter-in-law.
Daughter-in-law.
Moved back to the community with her mother-in-law, and so she's completely out of the realm of her community then.
Right, but I think as because she's not blood kin Naomi, I don't think that Naomi's claim to protection from her dead husband's kin necessarily
covered Ruth.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that Ruth was under this sort of
just because she was
insurance policy.
Whatever.
Yeah.
But Tamar was too. I mean, Tamar wasn't of the same blood.
She's not. Yeah. I think that the stories have some similarities and some differences, and we can move those around. But clearly, there's. I mean, if they're not altogether similar, they're certainly echoed in some ways. But I do think that it isn't quite. It's not as subversive in the same way that Ruth is in terms of. A real direct message about who's in and who's out. But I still think there's really cool similarities. Did you wanted to say something?
Well, I was thinking Boaz made the argument to the next of kin that Ruth did go along with Naomi.
Yes.
Fulfill your obligation to Naomi, and that includes Ruth too.
Yeah.
Whether he did that because he was interested in Ruth or because there was really a legal basis that I don't
know. Right. Yeah, it's hard to tell. But I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
This is just a little side point. I just went out to check, make sure I was right. The word onanism.
The word what?
Onanism.
Uh huh.
Comes from Onan here in the Bible.
Ah.
It's the withdrawal of during sexual intercourse, so the semen doesn't.
Is that right?
There's actually a word called onanism, which I had remembered rattling around in my brain. I just looked it up to make sure I was right, but it comes from onanism. It
comes right from here. There you go. That's no extra charge. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Could you hold 1 second? Because you were going to say something.
I would think this story and the story of Ruth, I just think to be in the Bible, where the culture of that time, where women were so property and chattel, that this got in, that these were wise people, that this, she was in the right and I was in the wrong.
Yeah.
Great story for a father to tell his daughter, okay, about, you know, there were some wise women in the world that did the right thing, and even the men acknowledged they did the right thing.
Uh-huh.
So I'm saying that there are good stories to be told to younger, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's a great point. And I was going to say that can you hold 1 second? That the subversion in the Tamar and Judah story is much more a subversion of our presuppositions. That when you read the story, immediately you start thinking of Tamar as this prostitute, and that brings in all this other stuff about, oh, you know, she's a prostitute, she's bad, she's da 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 da. And that, but she isn't that at all. And the end of the story redeems that. She's not, or enhances that idea that she's not at all doing anything bad. She is doing exactly what is right. Okay. And we have, we pull and tug. Well, wait a minute, the prostitute can't do something completely right, and she's not, but it subverts us. And so it makes us think, all right, well, now where does righteousness come from? And what does it mean to be made right? And who can make things right? It seems like, to me, that it makes my world start tumbling a bit. And that's where the subversion of this text is, to me. Did you have, no?
I was just going to say what Jacob thought of Judah. And he rates it quite highly.
Go ahead.
Okay, his firstborn, Reuben, he says, you are my firstborn, my might and the first fruits of my vigor, excelling in rank and excelling in power, unstable as water. That's what he says about Reuben. And he goes all down
right.
the line here, and then he comes to Judah and says, your brothers shall praise you, and your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp from the prey, my son, you have gone up. He crouches down, he stretches out like a lion, like a lioness who dares rouse him up. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him and the obedience of the people. Peoples is his. So he set him up as a ruler way back there. And of course later on he does Judah.
The tribe of Judah becomes the most influential, right? I mean, it's the whole southern kingdom, basically, along with Benjamin, right? So yeah. Yes.
I think a lot of the subversion in the story is a subversion of the whole power structure, in that someone who's powerless, i.e. a single woman who can't bear children, which is a commodity or at least a form of power in that society, period, that she can force someone who has power to see her, that's where the subversion comes for me. And part of the other subversion comes in part of the subversion that it causes in me, at least, and I'm not sure it's in the story, is to even question that the whole ideal or notion that to be a whole person, you have to be procreative. Mm. And I think that even in our society, that tumbles down to gay and lesbian people. Mm-hmm. When the parents, most parents are, one of their first reactions is of shame and, you know, I did something wrong, whatever. But a lot of it is, my line is not going to be completed. That, you know, a gay and lesbian person is less than whole because they can't procreate, theoretically, in their arms. Mm-hmm. Being family in a non-traditional way.
Right.
I think that for me, it brings up those old issues about that we place so much worth on being able to procreate as the relationships that we can have and the love that people can, the gifts that people have individually or from themselves, not just from their offspring.
Right. Yeah. Boy, what a great... that would be a great topic for discussion. Because it's real clear that the premium here in these stories is on keeping the bloodlines going, keeping those things going, because and that's simply a survival mechanism. But it's a survival mechanism that then gets translated into an ethical dimension, which, you know, that step between the survival and the ethics is a really, there's a lot of area in there that needs to be talked about, seems to me. So that would be, then, yeah, that's great, thanks. Yeah?
I learned once that because women had such a low place in society, they didn't have family to take care of them, that's often where prostitutes came from. Mm-hmm. So had Naomi and Ruth come back to their to the home, and Naomi found no relatives left, mm-hmm. who could do that for her, that might have been the only option that Ruth would have had.
Right.
I don't know. Is that
something
that you would agree with? I just heard learned that in classes earlier.
I think that's a real possibility. Sure.
Because there was nobody else. There were no social service agencies or anything.
Yeah, no safety net, right? Yeah.
Prostitutes were not prostitutes because...
it was a glamorous position, yeah.
It was because that was the only option left.
So. Exactly, yeah.
They were temple prostitutes anyway.
Right, and that's, right, exactly. Yes.
You kind of brushed over Onan rather quickly, and it seems to me that he didn't obey his father, he didn't do what he was supposed to do, he didn't obey the law, he didn't do anything he was supposed to do.
Right.
And he's really the bad guy because none of this would have happened had he done what he was supposed to do. So you wonder the relationships between those two brothers.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of goes back to the Cain and Abel. He must have really hated his brother that he didn't want to do this for his brother. So
yeah.
He disobeyed everything.
Yeah, and it isn't. There's not much made of it other than to say God didn't like it a lot and he killed him. Right? Yeah, right, yeah. I know.
Isn't?
Yeah, you're right. I think that's a piece of that just is a puzzle because you don't get that much information, but you get kind of a definitive statement, you know? But no, there's no, you don't have much to play with that. Yeah.
He's been perpetuated in the dictionary.
But yeah, yeah. He gets immortalized in the word, in the dictionary.
Against pride and self-righteousness, because mm-hmm. even though to himself he had relinquished his rights over Tamar, that in the eyes of the community he should have rights over her and obligations over her. And so when she became pregnant by playing around, to sort of to save face, he had to be the outraged relative. And he then asserted sort of a right to demand a death sentence, even over someone that he himself had already sort of relinquished.
Huh.
And not only was he sentencing her to death, he was sentencing the baby that she was carrying to death as well. And only when he discovered that the baby was his, did he realize that yes, indeed, there is a gift here that I can't refuse. This is a God-ordained outcome of my own actions. But if it had been someone else's child, he would have just said, it's not my child. She has, you know, basically there's been an adultery committed here against my kinfolk,
mm-hmm.
to death, you know, kill her. And I think there's sort of a strong message against that sort of pridefulness.
I think there is. I think there's a strong message against that self-righteousness that Judas has. But I think also that he has not relinquished claim against her. He simply has not done what he was obliged to do. And when she comes up pregnant, it's a great opportunity for him to get out of it, to get out of his obligation. All right, if we burn her, all right, I don't have to worry about my third son ever going to her. I save face in that way, which is, as you pointed out, and I don't have to risk losing my son by sending him to her. So I can kill a bunch of birds with one stone just by getting rid of her. Besides the fact that the child that she bears would muddle up my bloodlines,
right.
and inheritance issues. So all those things would be taken care of as long as Judah could kill Tamar. And then but then as you said, the revelation comes, and then it's all kind of this wonderful gift. And part of the connection between Judah, and the bell rang, but well, hang on. Between this story and, for example, the Jacob story is when they have the twins, right? She's got she has Perez and Zerah here down in, where is that now, in 29 and such, one hand gets stuck out, that's Zerah's, and the midwife puts a thing on that because that's the firstborn, right? And therefore gets the rights of the firstborn. And it harkens back to the whole business of Jacob and Esau, right? Struggling in the womb, and the second one who comes out is going to be ahead of the first. Well, Perez becomes the stronger of the two twins. All right, and it's his line that goes all the way to David. And of course, all that never would have happened had Tamar not. Another issue of there would be no King David without a Tamar, right? Which, just like Ruth. Another issue, of course, is the business of. Did we already talk about this? I forget, or it was the early one about recognizing your kinfolk. Huh? That remember when Joseph is down in Egypt, and the brothers come, and they don't recognize him, right? There's a little contact between the Joseph story there and here when Judah doesn't recognize Tamar, and recognizing who's related, and all those kinds of issues are all, you can kind of take a look and say, oh, you know, there's some issues here that connect the Joseph story and the Jacob story with the story of Judah and Tamar. And that's kind of fun. So it's not that it's, it is kind of plunked in there, but I think that there's these threads that help weave it together. And you might think about some others too that help connect this text to its surrounding, you know, with Joseph. And I think the biggest one is one we've already talked about, which is Joseph's claim, what you intended for evil, God meant for good. So it worked out. So there's Judah and Tamar. Tomorrow we have John 4, the story of the woman at the well, Jesus and the woman at the well. So you might want to read that. And,